Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. Earlier this week, we learned that Justin Bieber has been diagnosed with a condition. It's called Ramsay-Hunt syndrome, and it has fully paralyzed the right side of his face. I don't know about you, but I have never heard of this before. Apparently, it's like 1 in 20,000 people get it. And I want to understand what it is. How do you treat it? How common is it? All of those details. So joining us back on the show this morning is Dr. Zara Khan, who is a neurologist with the Neuroscience Institute at St. Vincent's Medical Center. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Khan. Thanks for being here. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So first of all, what is this syndrome? I've never heard of it.
Yeah. So this syndrome is a syndrome or a constellation of symptoms that occur together commonly caused by a herpes virus infection, and that give you most commonly three symptoms. You get your entire one half of the face becomes weak. You can also see at the same time some blisters occurring in the ear or near the ear, sometimes in the mouth, as well as ear pain. And this was briefly first described by an American neurologist, Dr. James Ramsay Hunt, who was an Army officer in World War I, and he was the first person to describe this syndrome. So it's named after him.
How common is it to get this?
So the incidence of Ramsay-Hunt syndrome is about 5 per 100,000 people per year in the U.S., and it's actually the second most common cause of lower motor neuron facial weakness, which means facial weakness that's not caused by a stroke. The most common causes that you may be familiar with is Bell's palsy.
I was just going to ask if the two are similar or what the difference, I guess, between the two are.
Sure. So Bell's palsy is when you purely just get weakness of one half of your face, and it's not accompanied by the other two features that you see in Ramsay-Hunt, which are the vesicles or blisters around the ear or surrounding areas and ear pain. You can get a pain behind the ear with Bell's palsy, but that is it. So I tend to think of them on a spectrum, Bell's being, you know, the purely just pain behind the ear and facial weakness. And then you take a few steps further with Ramsay-Hunt and you get a rash and ear pain. You can also get some additional features in both of them. So there is an overlap of symptoms. For example, you could get taste changes with both of them. The sounds can sound abnormally or drastically louder than they actually are. Mm. You can get ringing in the ears, and in severe cases, you can have hearing loss.
Yeah, and I know those are some of the things that Justin Bieber has said he is going through, the ringing in the ears and things like that. And we're talking this morning to Dr. Khan about this Ramsay-Hunt syndrome. And here's something that also kind of was alarming to me, Dr. Khan. How can you get it? Justin Bieber had sort of mentioned, you know, I've been under severe stress. I've been overworking. And he said, you know, I think that may have had a role in this. He kind of insinuated that it might have a role. But if that's the case, mm-hmm. I mean, stress is so common. I mean, I think it's still like one of the number one killers in America. Does stress cause mm-hmm. this? Like, what brings this on?
Absolutely. So stress is a risk factor for this, but this syndrome is primarily caused by a herpes virus. So people who have had, it's the same virus that causes chicken pox and shingles.
So oh,
chicken
wow.
pox in kids and shingles in adults. So when you get chicken pox, this virus actually then becomes inactive, and then it goes and hides in one of the structures in that's associated with your nerves. and it stays there dormant or asleep for even decades. And then when you are in times of extreme stress, people who have decreased or, you know, their immunity goes down due to whatever reason, whether they develop cancer or they're undergoing chemo, people who are developing infections for other cause or who are malnourished, then this virus sort of wakes up and can lead to this syndrome.
Wow, that's really scary. Now, I know you had said with the chicken pox, it's not going to eliminate it. It just kind of goes and hides. What about if you get shingles? Does it do anything? Does it give you a better chance of not experiencing it, or no?
It's mostly described as chickenpox. I mean, it's the same virus, so you can have it. You know, if it goes in dormancy and then at another time your body goes into stress, it's the same idea.
Okay, but I guess like it's not like if you get shingles, it means you're not going to get it.
So just because someone has had chicken pox or shingles doesn't guarantee that they're absolutely going to get it. It's just that they're at higher risk. These are the people that it's most commonly seen in.
I see. I got you. So what happens? Justin Bieber has this. I'm sure many people have this or have gone through this.
Mm-hmm.
How do you treat it? Does your face go back to the way it was prior to this happening?
So I'm again going to compare it a little bit to the Bell's palsy, or just the pure weakness of one side of your face. So in general, with Ramsey-Hunt syndrome, the facial weakness tends to be a tad bit more severe. So the recovery may not be 100%. A lot of people with Bell's palsy can have, like, I think 75 to 80% people can have full recovery. The telltale sign is how much do you recover in the first couple of days or the first week. So if you have experienced, for example, taste loss in this syndrome, and you get your taste sensation back within the first couple of days, then that's a very good prognostic sign. Or if you start to see a good amount of recovery in the first couple of weeks, that's a good sign. Then you become more hopeful about complete or nearly complete recovery. Problem with Ramsey-Hunt can be, you know, the sequela or the late effects that you could still feel that initially were there and you could still feel afterwards. Is if you get involvement of another structure that leads to all the ear problems, right? All the ear symptoms, such as ringing in the ears, it can give you hearing loss. Which may not be that much of a trouble for an average person, but for a singer like Justin Bieber, obviously it's going to be
a big problem. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking too.
Yeah.
Wow.
So usually it's temporary, but in rare cases can be permanent. So how to diagnose it? It's a clinical syndrome based on those three main things. Again, the facial weakness, rash or blisters near the ear or in the mouth, and ear pain on the same side. And you don't really need any special kind of testing to diagnose this. Viral studies can be done on the saliva or on the blood, but usually they're not needed. And you treat this with antivirals and steroids because you're trying to take the inflammation down. And you try to control the pain because it can actually be quite painful. Mm. And you want to protect their eye because of the facial weakness, a person can't close their eye properly. So particularly at nighttime, they have to use eye lubricant, ointment, and then tape their eyes so that it doesn't dry out.
Wow.
You know, in the few weeks, you hope that you would recover. And if you do, then that's a good sign.
Well,
it could take up to months sometimes.
Wow. Well, certainly prayers to Justin Bieber and to anybody who's going through this. It certainly doesn't sound like a fun journey, but a hopeful one. And Dr. Zara Khan, a neurologist with the Neuroscience Institute at St. V's, we really appreciate you coming on and explaining it to us. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
All right, Dr. Khan here on WICC.
Welcome to the show, Christopher Green. Chris, we're so glad that you reached out, and I can't wait to learn a little bit more about you here on the show. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Melissa, for having me on. Like you said, I think it's great that you're, you know, letting local politicians and candidates get on to talk about what's going on in Connecticut.
Oh, it's no problem. I love to learn myself, and I think that's the best way we can vote is if we really get to know the people who are running. And my big thing as an unaffiliated voter is I want to learn about people's campaigns, their platforms, why they get into this realm, versus just looking at the D or the R next to their names. And that's what I love to promote to my listeners, as well as open-mindedness and learning about people. So first of all, and I can say this because I'm often called out for my age, you're young. I like that, Chris Green. I do. I like that you're young. How old are you?
I am 36 years old, which doesn't feel that young, but definitely when I get to knocking doors, politically speaking, I'm a baby. But yeah, it's fun to try to represent younger generations and get our voices out there and fight for some representation.
I think so, too. Listen, I'm a baby, too, in the radio world, but that doesn't seem to be stopping WICC from being one of the top talk stations in the state. So, you know, go youngsters, as far as I'm concerned. So, Chris, tell us about yourself. You're a Connecticut native. You have a beautiful wife and daughter, only because I've been on your website. You're very blessed. But tell us about yourself, your upbringing. What got you into politics?
Yeah, so I grew up in the center of the state in Berlin, Connecticut. I went through public schools there, and worked hard in the classroom and got into running as a sport that I liked. That, you know, your direct work in your hard work is what determines your result there. And through my hard work in the classroom and on the track, I earned my way to Harvard University. I studied social sciences and education there. I came out of that and became a middle school math teacher, so jumping right in the trenches. And after 3 years of that, I moved into a really interesting mix of sort of business, education, and leadership. I started working for an after-school math enrichment program, which I was able to bring sort of two new branches to Connecticut, one in Wethersfield and the other in Stamford, and sort of spent 10 years growing that, you know, a team of about 30 teachers. We wound up serving about 2,000 students every week with after-school sort of math lessons. And about a year ago, to get ready for, starting a family, you mentioned we just had our first child, my daughter Francesca, in March, and also to look for something that was more public-facing as a way to apply sort of those team-building, those analytic, those communication skills I'd built. With the after-school enrichment, I stepped aside to look for something else. And midway through April, I realized, you know, that we didn't have two candidates running in the 21st district anymore. There was only one. And I thought, you know, there should be, in any political race, there needs to be, right, both sides at least represented.
So that was going to be my question. So this is your first go at any kind of a political title.
Yeah, about 2 years ago, I wound up with a little bandwidth. I got out there and joined my local Democratic town committee. I live in Stratford and have for the past 4 years. And that's a great way for anyone of any age who, you know, wants to get involved locally in politics is to start with your local either Democratic town committee or Republican town committee, you know, just showing up a few times and you wind up, you know, oftentimes a member who's responsible in a lot of cases for nominating local candidates and supporting them. I got roped into being treasurer for all 10 of our Democratic town council candidates in Stratford last year, which 10 sets of paperwork and filings in parallel was a whole bunch, but it was a great crash course in, you know, how politics works, and it was a great way to meet the network of sort of local candidates.
And I love that you are connected to the education system, because I do think there's a lot of brokenness in our mm-hmm. education system, and I do love that you have that under your belt as well, and you obviously understand children and the needs of them. And we're talking this morning to Chris Green. He is the Democratic candidate running for state Senate for the district that covers Stratford, Shelton, Monroe, and Seymour. It's currently held by incumbent Senator Kevin Kelly, who is on our show often during any of the legislative sessions that we have. Is that intimidating to you, Chris? I mean, Senator Kelly does very good work. People love him. He's been in office. He's the minority leader for the Senate Republicans. Is that intimidating to go up against a powerhouse like Senator Kelly?
I'm not intimidated. You know, the thing that I do like about local politics and state politics, though, is respect. You know, I've gotten out to a lot of doors already, and it's been such an energizing process. And one of the biggest things I see, you mentioned education, you know, and I'm huge on investments in our future, in our children. But I also view this as a great opportunity for education. I've already, you know, offered where I can, you know, to go into local schools and talk about civic engagement and talk about state and local politics. And even to do so, you know, with Senator Kelly, I think would be great. You know, I view this as an opportunity, like you said, for full transparency. And I definitely hope, you know, that he and I, as we get closer to election season, will have the ability to have some debates in our community. I look forward to, you know, hosting town halls, you know, as a candidate. And if I were elected, I'd want to do the same. I think it's great, you know, that Senator Kelly regularly, you know, is on your station as an elected official to help, you know, educate in terms of what's going on. But I also think getting out in the community and doing those regular town hall events is a huge part of it as well. And it's really been eye-opening to me how many people, you know, we have busy lives and we have so many different levels of government, and to stay on top of everything that's going on is tough. And I've really enjoyed this as an opportunity to, you know, let people know the kind of good things that I think have been happening at the state level. And in some cases where, you know, I think Senator Kelly really, you know, was voting sort of the wrong way on some of those really big issues.
So we're going to talk about that. We're chatting this morning with Christopher Green. Chris is running for state Senate, and he's going to be going up against Senator Kevin Kelly, representing the Democratic side. And of course, this would be for Stratford, Shelton, Monroe, and Seymour. And I want to talk a little bit about what Chris thinks has gone well in Connecticut, but what needs a little bit of improvement. So before the break, Chris, you had said, you know, I think there are things that Connecticut has done very well. Things that are passing in Hartford are good things. But there are things that specifically Senator Kelly has not voted the right way. Can you give us some examples?
Yeah. So I think, you know, obviously, the economy is a huge issue for a lot of us right now. And, you know, the role that the state plays through, you know, the taxes it collects and the money, you know, that it spends on services obviously is a part of that. And I thought that, you know, Democratic leadership in the state the last couple of years have done a really good job of balancing, especially considering, you know, the surplus the state had this year. That was, you know, some of it is sort of a one-time event related to inflation. And they took that opportunity to get ahead and plan for the future. So I thought it was a great balance of, you know, $600 million in targeted tax cuts for working middle-class families, especially helping families with children, especially helping retirees. I thought that is great and timely. But as a math teacher, as a math guy, I love it when the numbers work in our favor long term as well. And I thought what we did, or, you know, what was done relating to the pension debt, you know, in the last two budget cycles alone, paying $5 billion extra into a program that for the last 10 decades, you know, governors on both sides had kicked the can. And that's our credit card debt. That's money piling up that we're owing to, you know, workers who worked with that promise. And obviously, it's important, I think, to honor that promise. 10 years ago, you're talking about, you know, looking at either having to cut back what was promised, or I know they were even floating the idea of putting that down onto towns, which our property taxes are so high already. That would have been incredible. And now we're in a place where we're heading to be, you know, back on track with that. And that's going to save us over $400 million a year, every year moving forward. And, you know, when you're talking about something that size, when a $600 million tax cut this year is you know, the biggest we've ever gotten, you know, or one of the biggest tax cuts we've ever gotten. It's almost that size of a tax cut every single year. And it's a snowballing effect because it also increases, you know, if you think about sort of we have credit card debt and you have a credit rating, the government's credit rating, their bond rating has been improved by this stewardship. And that means that all the debt that we have is going to be more, you know, we're going to be able to get it more affordable. And I'm all for, you know, common sense, long-term financial planning like that. I thought it was a really good move. And I know Kevin right now is pushing, you know, times are tough, you know, for you know, more tax cuts. But to do that, he's trying to take it out of those payments to get us back on track. And that's really going to undercut, you know, our long-term financial progress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of the things that he really stands for. And I think, you know, what's interesting about what you're saying is, and that could get lost in translation sometimes, is like we're living in the here and now. So we need to help the people who can't afford it. And, you know, what I think is interesting is I hear what you're saying, Chris, which is, look at the long term. If we don't start paying these things down now, it's only going to be it's going to cost us more in the long run. And I think both points are really important. I think it's good to have both sides on, because what you're saying makes sense.
Absolutely.
It logically makes sense what you're saying. And what's also interesting, Chris, is that, you know, when we cut the sales tax, for example, for that 1 week, or when we cut the gas tax, you know, until December 1st, most people are still saying, yeah, but I'm struggling. That's not really doing anything for me. So I think, if I'm hearing you correctly, and of course I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what I think I hear you saying is, look, we could give more of these incentives, but it really, it's not going to change what we are dealing with inflation and what we're dealing with economically right now. And at the end of the day, if we could use that money more effectively, so when we do get over this hump of inflation and use it to put down for long-term goals for Connecticut, you're saying that's the better investment than doing these tax cuts, is I think what I'm hearing, correct?
Well, I don't want to make this either or, but I want to make it clear this is an and, right? That we've already given the $600 million in tax cuts that are kicking in here, you know, and in addition to this planning ahead, and in addition to this having a rainy day fund, because we don't know if, you know, this inflation is going to turn into a recession. And, you know, I really get that it's a really tough sell. People are struggling right now. But like you said, the size of, you know, the cuts that are being proposed here. And the other part of that is, you know, the state passed a budget, which, you know, Kevin voted against, and it included this balance of tax cuts, investment in early childhood education, investment in mental health, and investment in paying down our debts. But he has never proposed an actual counter budget while in session. And so now we're after session, and he's, you know, holding rallies and issuing press releases about, you know, moving this money around. But even that, it's not a budget, it's a press release. And I think as the minority, you know, party leader, if he really wants to get concrete and specific with this, A, it would have been great if he did that while they were actually in session. And B, it would have been great if it was a full and comprehensive budget and not just a sort of a talking point.
Mm-hmm. I can't speak for Kevin Kelly, but I want to make an educated guess and say I believe he had made pushes for the Republicans' own version. Like, I believe I thought they did make document versions. I thought. I could be wrong, but I thought they did.
What they released was a list of the taxes that they would cut.
Gotcha.
They didn't, until the last few weeks, give how that would be paid for. And now they have issued the statement that, right, I think that money basically would come from these payments ahead on the pension program. And that's where I'm saying we did do tax cuts. We did do this. You know, I feel like, you know, that is a big thing, is that, you know, the timing on this is interesting to me. Mm. And the other, you know, big one for me, now Kevin was the only Senate Republican to run unopposed in 2020. So I know and since our Senate races are only 2-year cycles, it seems, you know, in a lot of cases to bring up something that happened before that wouldn't make sense. But since he hasn't had an opponent since 2018, I think it's important to talk about the things he voted against in 2019. And one of the biggest ones for me is the paid leave program that we have in Connecticut. This country, you know, as a country, we've fallen so far behind other countries in the developed world when it comes to taking care of our working our workers when they get hurt, when they get sick, or when you have children. You know, that we're one of the only countries that doesn't have any, you know, mandatory leave for mothers, you know. And Connecticut took a huge step forward in 2019 with a program that was well-researched and audited to be, you know, affordable and stable and effective, and as a way to give us this ability to help, you know, working families, middle-class families. And I know we talk a lot about all the different, you know, costs of, you know, the families in this country breaking down. Gone are the days, right, when a middle-class family can afford to have one parent who's home all the time. And that's where a bill like that, where at least when people get hurt, sick, or when you have that child for the first few weeks of life, to be able to afford to stay home with them.
Both parents.
You know, that was a huge bill.
Yeah.
That was a huge bill to me that made sense, that was sustainable, and that he voted against and as far as I'm aware, continues to oppose. I'd point that out as well.
Yeah. Well, Chris Green, unfortunately, we have run out of time. I want people to know about your website, which is Chris Green, Green for Senate, with the number 4 Senate.com, and you can learn more about some of the issues, where Chris stands on them, and learn a little bit more about him, and of course contact him if you want to learn more. Chris, thank you so much for contacting the show, and don't be a stranger, certainly as we get closer to election season. We'd love to have you back on.
I would love it as well. You've been great. Thank you so much for the time and for the question.
Thank you. Appreciate your time. That's Chris Green here on WICC.
It's time to get out and explore.
Melissa in the Morning brings you science you may not know on Southern Connecticut's news and information leader, WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
You know, David, sometimes I feel like you and I share one brain. David Mestre, who hosts Science You May Not Know here on The Morning Show. I was thinking about this the other day because this was a big story, and I thought, first of all, let's make sense of it because it's kind of creepy, and I want to understand it a little bit more. A Google engineer got into some trouble earlier this week when he announced that the conversations he was having with a Google AI program were so convincingly real that he thought it was capable of expressing thoughts and feelings like a human child. Creepy. David Mestre, what can you tell me about this story? Good morning.
So the engineer was a guy by the name of Blake Lemoine, and he was actually working with a special kind of a chat bot.
A chat bot, okay.
Yep. It's a Google AI program. It's called Lambda, and the project stands for Language Model for Dialogue Applications.
Okay.
So that's what Lambda is. And so what happened is that, you know, Lambda is kind of like a digital assistant. You can speak to it and it kind of responds.
Like Alexa?
Like Alexa, yeah,
okay.
Exactly, yeah, which is in my room right now.
Sorry, Alexa, I didn't mean to wake you up there. Sorry.
I know, she might actually start talking about, but I can ask her if she feels self-aware too. So that might be kind of fun.
Oh, good Lord, no, I'm not ready to freak myself out. Not this early in the morning.
Exactly. Yeah. So Lambda, as the engineer was, you know, speaking with Lambda, you know, typing in and getting a response, typing in, getting a response. What was happening was that Lambda just sounded like it's real, like it's I'm actually having a real conversation with this machine. Like, it understands that it's speaking to me, and maybe that tells me that this machine understands its own existence.
But how is that possible?
Yeah, now how is that possible? So one of the big questions is how could we ever really know? You know, how could we actually ever test? So scientists need to come up with a test to be convincing, right? I mean, we just can't base this on a single engineer. You know,
right.
How would we know? And so this testing is actually pretty old, this idea that we could actually test a machine to see whether or not it's actually thinking. And this goes back to the 1950s with a mathematician by the name of Alan Turing, who's a very famous mathematician, cryptologist, and pioneer of computer science. And so he came up with a test that says, okay, well, let's have a terminal that you can type into. And the terminal can send you to two conversations, one with a machine and one with a person. And then you just start texting and having these conversations. And the idea is that you're the judge as to whether you're having a conversation with a machine or whether you're having a conversation with a person.
Interesting.
And if you get to the point where you have several judges working these terminals, and they can't tell who the machine is and who the person is less than 50% of the time, like a flip of a coin, if you can't really tell, then that machine has gotten to the point where it's convincingly communicating to you like a person would.
I don't like that.
I know, yeah.
I like that test, but I don't like that idea that a machine could do that. That's
The thing is that we, you know, AI engineers would never apply a Turing test because the problem is that a person who's the judge really wants to think that they're talking to another person.
Right.
And so if you can, like our engineer Blake Lemoyne had happened to him, you know, Blake is talking to this machine, and Blake really wants to believe that the machine is actually thinking. And that got him into a little trouble, you know, because he was also printing out basically sending out to people the actual text. You know?
I was just going to say, why did he get into trouble? I didn't understand that.
Yeah, and part of it is because this is actually these are classified projects.
I see. So he shouldn't have been. I gotcha. Okay.
He shouldn't have been, you know, sending all this information out and putting it on the web and sharing it with the media and all that kind of stuff because these are projects that people are working on at Google because what, you know, and AI is all over the place. You know, we're trying to create these kinds of systems because, you know, when we want to interact with a machine, you know. Originally, you have to know coding. You have to know how to program a machine so that it can perform these instructions. But that's not how we really tell people what to do. You know, we would like to be able to tell people what to do in, or at least a machine what to do in our language, you know, the way that we speak. And it's almost like, and I don't know if you remember the old, TV program, Knight Rider.
Sure.
Knight Rider actually had an assistant on board, and that was Kit. But Kit became sort of a character in the TV series. We never mm-hmm. thought of it as a machine. We thought of it as just another sidekick that was in the TV series. Because
the Jetsons.
Yeah. Because the language that Kit was using was so convincing mm-hmm. to the person that's in the car that it's almost like Kit was another person. But engineers today would never consider that. It literally just uses languages and not understands, but at least we have algorithms that allow us to take these different words and sentences and syntax and combine them together so that these rules help the computer to be able to communicate with us in a way that we understand. And it's kind of a weird thing. I mean, in fact, sometimes people actually, we use reverse Turing engines. You know, how do we convince a computer that we're not a computer? You know,
because they'll ask, like, is this a robot, is this a whatever, and you have to take those little tests.
Like, am I looking at a taxi cab, is this a traffic light?
Test us. That's so weird.
Yeah, so how does a computer, how do we convince a computer I'm not a computer?
It's above my pay grade. But
you know, the thing is that's really kind of cool is that, you know, we're talking to each other on the telephone. And on the telephone, I can't see you. And so, but I know you're Melissa.
Well, you think.
Yeah, that's right. Wow.
Now, see, now I'm going to flip the script on you. How do you know I'm not using my robot version of myself that sounds eerily like me, just sitting
right.
in for me so I could take a quick nap? How do you
that's
know?
That's correct.
How
and I failed know? This Turing test, and all these judges discovered that convincingly the Melissa chatbot was so good that it's actually running a radio show.
Isn't that crazy? I know. Wow. Yeah. Boop. Honestly, though, I know we're joking, but it is a serious thing where I feel like we're going to get to a point where we're like, how do we know who we're talking to is real or is not? It's crazy.
There's a great program for the 1960s. It was called Eliza. And Eliza was sort of like a chatbot, an early version of a chatbot. And the funny thing was the engineer that created this Eliza program was really trying to show how you really can't have a meaningful conversation with a machine. But what happened was that Eliza was so convincing that people actually thought Eliza was a person, and they'd actually use Eliza for psychotherapy.
I've been extremely good about not bringing up Disney as often as I'd like to. But I think this example is needed. We're talking for Science You May Not Know about this Google engineer who got in trouble because he shared information about the conversations he was having with a chat bot, essentially. And he started to think, you know, maybe this thing has sentiment. Maybe it has thoughts and feelings, and it's kind of like a human child. So it sort of freaked him out. David, back in the late 90s, early 2000s, you may or may not remember, but a Disney Channel movie came out called Smart House. Did you ever watch Smart House?
I did not.
Fantastic movie. Watch it on Disney Plus. I'm just saying, it's very good. Anyways, the premise of the movie is it was a smart house. A family, a father and his two kids, won a contest to move into essentially a house you probably could find in today's world. All smart devices, but even bigger than what we have now. You talk and essentially Alexa or the house can make anything happen. If you're like, oh, I really want to be in Disney World right now, the room all of a sudden magically turns to Disney World. Like, it was unbelievable. But this robot who ran the house picked up on the emotions and the feelings and took in memories of the family that when she does come to life, quote unquote, like when she takes human form, she's not a robot anymore because she has feelings. She now has feelings because she's developed them by watching and taking in like a sponge the people around her. So my question is, with these robots, I understand trying to differentiate, okay, how do I know I'm talking to a robot or not? Mm-hmm. But how do we know that robots aren't capable of taking it? I mean, they're very smart, obviously. I mean, we've got some of the most brilliant people making them. How do we know they're not like little sponges, like little toddlers who are taking in things, and now all of a sudden they have developed feelings and appropriate behaviors that would make them seem not robotic anymore? Does that make sense, what I'm asking?
Yeah, and I think you know, an engineer would look at that and go, what that is really us transferring onto the machine things that we would ascribe to human qualities. Because I think maybe for us, and this is probably saying more about us than it really is about the machine, is that we really have this sort of deep desire for connections. And if this deep desire for connections is encounters a machine that's really capable of these kinds of natural language interactions, you know, it's almost like a natural thing for us to think, oh my gosh, I'm actually talking to something that has some real sentience to it. Even though its existence, this machine's existence, is only really, you know, millions or even billions of lines of code and data and information that's collected, and it's only giving us what we have given it. Kind of, if that's kind of understandable.
Right, so it doesn't have a heart, essentially. So, like, things like empathy, it's not like you could teach what we are feeling. They can just take whatever they're seeing or taking in, essentially. So there's only so far that they could go to mask real
correct.
Feeling.
And so I think, okay. So I actually, you know, when I was a kid, you know, I actually went to a science museum. And at this science museum, they actually had a terminal. And at the terminal was the ELISA program. And
oh,
so,
cool.
You know, yeah, so this is the, you know, from the night, and this is a program for the 1960s. And from an MIT engineer by the name of Joseph Weizenbaum. And so Weizenbaum created this chatbot in the 1960s. So this has been going on for a very long time.
Yeah.
But the funny thing was that he wanted to prove that we can't have any real connection or conversation with the machine, because the way the chatbot worked was that it would actually kind of take your information that you typed in, rearrange it, and kind of give it back to you.
Like, wow.
Yeah, so like you would type in, "Hi, Eliza, how's your day?" And then the chatbot would go back, "How's your day?"
I see.
And
that's interesting.
Wow. Yeah, and so, but what was so funny about that was that, you know, Eliza kind of took on, in the digital world, I guess, in sort of like in the Silicon world, mm-hmm. It kind of took on a life of its own, because people actually created their own conversations with Eliza that were deeply meaningful to them.
Wow!
Because of the way that Eliza interacted, there are stories that Joseph Weizenbaum's secretary would kick him out of the office so that she could talk to Eliza and have a little session with Eliza and kind of talk to her about her problems. You know?
Wow. I mean, hey, you know what? I talk to my dog and he doesn't talk back. So, you know, we all have somebody.
Yeah. And I think that's another analog, too. I mean, how do we know that our dogs
are not processing what we're saying.
Yeah. Are processing and understanding.
Well, now that we should do a segment on, David. If we want to do some research on that, I would love to do that. How do we know if they're understanding us or not? They may not be able to respond, but I've always wondered that. I've always wondered about talking about animals and how they respond to things and do they have feelings and things like that. Can we do
Absolutely.
A segment on that?
Yeah, I think so. I'll do a little bit of research. You know, I think one of my favorite animals is like the octopus. The octopus, they're brilliant. They really are.
Well, see, I didn't know that. So we're gonna talk about that probably maybe next time or in the near future. David Mastry, I love having you on. Thank you for doing Science You May Not Know each and every week. We appreciate
it. Absolutely. But I think Bill Jacqueline, I think he's a machine.
You think he's a machine, huh?
I totally do.
I mean, he does get it's eerily accurate how he gets the weather right. Like, no other meteorologist will peg things, and Bill will, and it's like,
he's got to have access to all this data information.
I'll have to press him on that. We'll have to use one of those tests.
We're going to have a Turing test with Bill Jacqueline.
There you go. I like it. David Mastry, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Take care.